Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, April 23, 2014, during a live courthouse steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, our topic is the Argentina bond case, Argentina versus NML Capital, argued earlier this week in the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. This call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future, and this call is open to the press. We're going to hear from a returning presenter and expert today with only a brief introduction as usual so we can get to the heart of our presentation and then ultimately to the questions from our audience. Today's call features Professor Michael D. Ramsey. He's the Hugh and Hazel Darling Foundation Professor of Law and Director, International and Comparative Law Programs at the University of San Diego School of Law. His full bio is available on our website and in the notice of today's call, so I'd direct you to that if you have any further questions about his background. But with that, Professor Ramsey, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much, Dean, and thanks to everyone for being here. And thanks to the Federalist Society for having me here. I just want to say a few words about Republic of Argentina versus NML Capital, and then I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have. So the underlying facts of this case, stated real briefly, are that Argentina sold bonds to private investors, one of which is NML Capital, and then defaulted on the payment of the bonds. And in the bond contracts, Argentina had waived its sovereign immunity and consented to jurisdiction in New York. And so after the default, NML sued Argentina in New York, just as the contracts contemplated. And the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, which is a U.S. statute, says that foreign governments can be sued in the U.S. in certain circumstances. And one of those circumstances is when the sovereign waives its immunity. So there isn't any question that NML could sue Argentina. And that's not what this case is about. What this case is about is what NML could do after it won, which it did win on the merits, and then Argentina still refused to pay, which it did. And so NML needed some way to collect the judgment. Now, the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act also says that judgment creditors cannot execute on foreign sovereign assets in the United States unless the assets are being used in a commercial capacity, for a commercial purpose. So the next thing that happened was that NML asked the trial court to order two New York banks that handle Argentina's finances to disclose what they knew about Argentina's assets. And the trial court did this. As NML requested, the order covered all Argentina's assets, not just commercial assets and not just assets in the United States. And that becomes the central point of this case, because Argentina, supported by the U.S. executive branch, claims that this discovery order violates the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. The question that the Supreme Court confronted on Monday in the oral argument is whether the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act bars this sort of discovery request or this sort of discovery order. My view is that it doesn't. The text is of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act is pretty clear. With respect to execution, it has a section 1609, that specifically protects non-commercial assets against, quote, arrest, attachment, and execution, end quote. But it doesn't say that assets are immune from disclosure. It doesn't say anything about disclosure. And in other respects, the FSIA, section 1606 of the Act, says that a non-immune sovereign, subject to some exceptions aren't relevant here, that a non-immune sovereign shall, quote, be liable to in the same manner and to the same extent as a private individual under like circumstances. So what I take away from this, and what I think the court was taking away from it in the oral argument, although, of course, oral arguments are notoriously hard to to decipher. But what I take away from this is that the FSIA itself doesn't really say anything about disclosure of assets in aid of execution. And instead, the rule as applied to a non-immune sovereign like Argentina is just the same rule that would be applied to a private individual. And for me, that then brings the case to Rule 69 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, which is the federal rule that that governs execution in ordinary litigation. And it says that a district court can order discovery in support of execution. And it's a very brief section, and it doesn't have any particular categorical limits. It appears to leave everything to the discretion of the district court. But my understanding is that that in private litigation, courts acting under Rule 69 routinely require disclosure of assets that are outside of the particular jurisdiction and arguably not subject to execution. Justice Scalia made this point a number of times during the oral argument that that if this were a private party, that the district court could ask it disclosed, to direct it to disclose assets that were, for example, located overseas. The concern on the other side, I think, is that, and some justices voiced this at the oral argument, that Argentina or other foreign sovereigns might have to disclose the location of sensitive diplomatic or military assets, that they might have particular sovereign concerns that aren't related to, that aren't analogous to the kind of concerns that private parties have. I think that's a fair concern. I'm not sure it's true that private parties also have concerns about secrecy, trade secrets, for example. But in any event, I don't think this undermines the conclusion, which I get from looking at the text of the matter, the text of the statutes, that that it's really Rule 69 that's in play here, not the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. Rule 69 would allow district courts to make orders that took into account sovereign concerns like sensitivity of diplomatic assets and so forth. There's plenty of discretion in Rule 69, and district courts are used to dealing with that. In any event, the disclosures here were just about financial transactions, so they got off on questions about disclosures about concerning airplanes and so forth, but that's not what this case is about directly anyway. This is about disclosing financial transactions. And in any event, it seems to me that if there really are concerns about secrecy, and I don't doubt there are, but these are handled in private with respect to private parties and trade secrets and so forth, that you can make disclosures confidentially to the court, and hopefully that would all take care of that. I think it's worth noting that. So I guess to back up, Argentina says though, why would you need to require disclosure of non-exempt assets? Of non-commercial assets. That is, assets that are exempt from execution. And why would you need to disclose assets worldwide when we're really just talking about a U.S. court? I think that the answer to that is twofold. With respect to the worldwide discovery, again, I think that's fairly routine for private parties, that they can be ordered to disclose worldwide assets, because in enforcement of the judgment, the prevailing party can take the judgment overseas and collect on it. And indeed, that can be done in some countries, even as to non-commercial assets of sovereign nations. We have the rule that you can't execute on non-commercial property, but that's not the rule in many countries overseas. As to the question of whether non-commercial property in the U.S. It should be subject to the discovery order, what NML says, and I admit to having a fair amount of sympathy for this, is that you can't really know what assets can be executed on until you know what assets are there. And if there may be disputes as to whether an asset is commercial or not, this is not really a bright line. You don't want to rely just on Argentina or just on the foreign sovereign generally. I'm not making any not trying to impugn Argentina here, but you don't want to rely on the foreign sovereign or the foreign sovereign's banks to make a non-reviewable conclusion that, oh, this doesn't look like a foreign sovereign asset. This doesn't look like a commercial asset to me, so I don't have to disclose it. That's going to leave NML not knowing what's out there and not able to argue to the judge, this is rightly a commercial asset, even though Argentina says that it's not. In any event, these are the sorts of things that I think the Rule 69 allows a district court to balance, and the kind of bright line rule that Argentina wants to come out of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, just in my reading, doesn't exist. And indeed, the Argentina and the United States in support have relied on the spirit of the act rather than any actual text. That is my bottom line assessment, I guess, is that this is really a Rule 69 case, not a Foreign Sovereign Immunities case. And I thought there were indications in the oral argument that the court was reading it the same way. And I think it would not be a bad idea if the court gave some guidance about how Rule 69 would be applied in sovereign cases, because Rule 69 is really not a very helpful rule. It's just very short and leaves everything to the district court. And maybe some guidelines are needed as to how to handle specific asset by asset judgments or assessments of what needs to be done to protect the sovereign. But this is the kind of thing I think district courts are pretty good at. So that's why Rule 69 leaves it mostly to them. In any event, that's my cut at the case. And I think where I come back to at the beginning is that I think it's important to remember that Argentina got itself in this situation for good reason, but I end up with not too much sympathy for them in the sense that, in the first place, they voluntarily consented to jurisdiction in New York, understanding what that would mean. They didn't have to do that. It's entirely voluntary. They could have not done that, but of course, if they hadn't done that, it would have been much more difficult for them to sell their bonds. And so they did it in order to gain a commercial advantage. And I don't see any unfairness in holding them to that. And as to the disclosures, they can avoid any onerous disclosures that they face if they want, simply by doing what they're supposed to do anyway, which is to pay the judgment against them. All of this is happening is because Argentina is refusing to pay a judgment validly entered against them. So I think it's a difficulty somewhat of Argentina's own making, I would be disappointed if the court read a provision into the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act that's not really there. The Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act is difficult enough statute to read just with the text itself, and I don't think we need to add to it to deal with this particular case. But again, that's just my view, I do think that the real key to this case is whether one thinks that discovery of this type, which is important to execution of a just sovereign judgment, and that, of course, is important to the rule of law as to sovereign contracts. The question is whether execution like this should be left largely to the district court, subject to abuse of discretion oversight through Rule 69, or whether we ought to create some kind of blanket exception from the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, a blanket exception that doesn't exist in the text and might well have the effect of interfering with creditors' ability to identify assets on which to execute. So I think I will leave it right there and see if that's provocative enough to inspire some questions.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Ramsey. I think I'm sure we will have some questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. When you hear that announcement, if you have a question today for Professor Ramsey, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for Professor Ramsey, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see if someone rings in with a question, let me make a brief commercial announcement. I will continue to plug the Federal Society's second annual Executive Branch Review Conference, which is scheduled for May 7th at the Mayflower Hotel. Details of that conference are available on the front page of the Federal Society's website, but I can tell you that we'll have addresses by Congressman Tom Cotton, Senator Ted Cruz, and several panels in between. It's a day-long conference with CLE available, so I'd encourage people to take a close look at that. In terms of upcoming Teleform conference calls, tomorrow at noon we're featuring a call on encryption. Friday at noon we'll be talking about mental capacity and capital punishment, which is another Supreme Court case that was argued this week. And we already have three Teleform conference calls scheduled for early next week, so check our website and monitor your emails for announcements there. Today, of course, we're talking to Professor Mike Ramsey about the Argentina bond case. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Before we go to our first caller, let me ask you, Professor Ramsey, if I could, to say a little bit more about the distinction here between what's allowed in discovery versus what's allowed in execution. And I know there are some concerns that there could theoretically be a loophole created by the court in that might allow Argentina to shield from discovery certain assets if the court adopts a categorical rule in that regard.
First of all, sure. The background from the FSIA is that in the United States, commercial assets are subject to execution as long as the sovereign has waived his immunity, which Argentina has here. So there's any question about of that, but that commercial, that non-commercial assets in the United States are not subject to execution, even if the sovereign has waived immunity as to them, which Argentina did, but that immunity remains in the United States. Execution in foreign countries is obviously governed by foreign law. In many foreign countries, there are some non-commercial assets that would also be subject to execution, given Argentina's waiver of sovereign immunity. So, I can't really speak to exactly what would be going on in foreign countries. I think, the one concern I suppose is that there's the court might adopt, I think what you're suggesting, possibly a middle ground, which would be to allow, some discovery, to go forward, but to create certain categories, and I believe this was suggested in the oral argument, that to create certain categories that wouldn't be subject to execution, wouldn't be subject to discovery, because they are clearly outside of the area of the assets that would be subject to execution. So an example might be you have a rule that said no military assets are subject to the discovery order. I think that's what you're suggesting, is that a possible middle ground.
It is. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was going to say I think there's two problems with that middle ground. The first problem is it seems to me that at least if you're looking at the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, there's nothing in the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act that would suggest what these categories would be, the court would just be sort of making it up, which I think it would be. Better done by the district court on a case-by-case basis rather than the Supreme Court trying to come in over the top with a rule that they're just sort of creating, because the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act doesn't have anything on this, and some kinds of assets that wouldn't be subject to execution in the United States might be in foreign countries, so you start making rules about disclosure, you might be not capturing what the foreign law would be. But I think the other concern that NML has on this is that if you create blanket exceptions, then you also may be creating loopholes that can be exploited by the by the sovereign defendant. So I had to get oral argument. I think NML's counsel mentioned that, well, if you have a rule that says no military assets can be discovered, then the sovereign might suddenly decide that all of its assets were actually military assets and start and put military insignia on all its assets. And then even ones that were being used as for commercial purposes, and then, or arguably at least, which would be subject to execution in the United States. So the problem is that if you have a categorical exceptions, these could become loopholes. And it's better, as NML's position is better just to have all the assets on the table, and that doesn't mean that the assets are subject to execution, just they're disclosed, but they're not. The execution rules are just completely different.
Right. Okay. And I take it, I mean, I remember hearing about this case before. This is the case in which in the Second Circuit, Argentina's counsel, there's some video that circulated on this, said words to the effect, and I'm paraphrasing here, that his client, Argentina, would not comply with an order of the court, an order of the Second Circuit Court. So I guess I'm asking you if that, in your mind, would make the loophole one that Argentina might very well be likely to try and walk through.
Yeah, well, again, I don't have anything particularly against Argentina. I don't want to say anything particularly against Argentina, although I do think that Argentina has been notably uncooperative in this case, in the stating that even after there's a judgment against it, saying it really doesn't recognize that judgment, doesn't think that judgment's valid, and won't cooperate with paying it. So they are being very resistant to it, so I can understand why NML is concerned that Argentina might use loopholes, but I didn't want to say anything particularly against Argentina, but just
sure.
In the more general case, you're worried as a judgment creditor when you have a debtor that's sort of actively refusing to pay, you're worried that if there are areas that the district court just isn't allowed to look into in the discovery process, that things might be hidden in those areas. And
right.
So I think transparency at the discovery stage, unless there's a really good reason for it, and I think there may be as on some particular assets. I think there might well be concern. I mean, you know, if they have secret military institutions in Argentina, you know, we're not going to order them to disclose the locations of them or something like that. But but that's again something that's handled case by case and is. Or asset by asset, I mean, and there's nothing in this particular order, because this particular order is just about financial transactions, nothing in this particular order that would go at something like the location of military assets or something like that.
Right. Okay, once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one caller with a question. Let's see what's on the mind of our callers.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, we can hear you just fine. Go right ahead, caller.
Okay. Thank you so for doing this. My name is Silvia Pisani. I am with La Nación newspaper in Argentina, here in Washington. And the question to Mr. Ramsey is this one. As you well know, this is a very complicated story, a very complicated case with so many windows. And now we are talking about only one window, which is the discovery one. And I don't know if you are familiar with the whole story, but if that is the case, I would like to ask you if you see any link between this hearing and the oral argument that we heard on Monday and the main cause, which is the one called Pari Passu, because everybody was speculating that maybe we were going to see on Monday some kind of message of where the court may turn to the main cause, which is the Pari Passu. But I didn't find anyone. I didn't find any clue about what the court may resolve about that. So I would like to ask you if you have the same impression, or if you are smarter than me, which I guess, and you can explain us if there is any link or any clue of what this direction may be.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for that question. And I am familiar with the broader outlines of this case. I did quite oversimplify the facts in leading into this one. This is a very complicated case with a lot of pieces to it, as she says. And that's exactly right. And it's also exactly right that this particular issue, the discovery issue, is not really even the biggest issue maybe that there might be coming out of this case. And the bigger issue, which is sort of lined up behind this one, is what the question refers to as the pari passu case, which is basically just real quickly, and I'm going to be oversimplifying here, but real quickly for those people who don't know this one, in the bond contract, that there's a provision that says, well, it arguably says, but this is what the district court held it said, and I think rightly so, that all the bondholders basically had to be treated the same. So pari passu, treated in the same way. So what happened was, after Argentina defaulted, it then reached a refinancing agreement with a number of the bondholders, which where the bondholders agreed to take a lower amount of repayment in return for actually hopefully getting something out of their bonds. But NML didn't take that deal wants to get paid in full. And so what NML says is that the pari passu clause says that Argentina can't pay on the refinance bonds without making equivalent payments to NML. And it asked the district court for an order to that effect, and the district court gave an order to that effect, and the Second Circuit affirmed it. That's what you're referring to, right? And I realize I'm radically oversimplifying, but that's the basic thrust of it.
Great.
And this is a big deal, because right now the dispute with Argentina and NML just involves a couple of bondholders, because many of the bondholders, at least in dollar terms, took the renegotiated deal. But if Argentina can't pay it on its renegotiated bonds, then it's going to default on those bonds as well. And then there's going to be a lot more unhappy people out there asking Argentina for money. And Argentina regards the district court order under the pari passu as being also an infringement on the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act's rules on execution in support of judgments. And so that's why it's a lot like this case, and I think it's a lot like this issue that was argued on Monday. I think it's a lot like it, not just because it comes out of the same case and because it involves collection on Argentina's assets, but also because, again, my view is that Argentina is trying to find something in the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act that isn't there. The injunction that the district court issued in respect of the pari passu clause doesn't encompass any execution on assets, and so the Argentina has to try to read the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act broadly in the spirit of the act to protect the sovereign rights more broadly than just in respect of execution. So that I do see the cases as being closely linked. And then going back to the question, to actually try to answer the question, although I really can't, I agree with the question that. I didn't see anything in the oral argument that really tipped a hand on that point. I think if the questions had been more hostile to NML and sort of more embracing of Argentina's Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act argument here, that would strongly suggest that they also were sympathetic on the pari passu question. But I thought that looked at from Argentina's perspective, sort of at best the questions were neutral, and actually maybe I'm reading into this just sort of agreement with my own view, which is easy to do, but I thought that the court, or at least a number of the justices, seemed to think that the appeal to the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act didn't really work in this case. And like I said, it really was a Rule 69 question. And if that's the way they're thinking about this case, then that might suggest they would also think that the Perry Pasu issue was not a Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act question, but again, a question of the district court's ability to give injunctive relief under the appropriate parts of the federal rules. But again, that's just pure speculation, and I think I would agree with the question that I didn't see anything in the oral argument that that made me think they were definitely leaning one way or the other on the Perry Pasu question. The Perry Pasu question is, I believe, is now being briefed on cert. I think that's right, although I'm not absolutely sure about that. So they know about that issue. Justices know about this issue. They know it's coming. They will see what they have to say about it. But I don't think I have anything more to say about it than that.
Once again, if you have a question today for Professor Michael Ramsey, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open at this point. Let me ask you while we're waiting to see if somebody else rings in, Professor, is this a case, I mean the present case, the argument from Monday, is this one that will wait until the very end of the term for a decision? Or do you have any sense of that?
I mean,
two scant months, but...
Right. I think my answer to that is I think yes it will because it's a complicated question I guess it didn't in looking at the oral argument it didn't seem to me that the justices thought it was an easy case easy in the sense that they could knock it out in a couple of weeks. We are very close to the end of the term, as you know. By tradition, all of the cases have to be done by the end of June, which is not that long from now. And they have a lot of other things going on as well in terms of getting cases wrapped up. So it's not like they can turn to this one immediately. My prediction is that it would be maybe not one of the very last cases, but it would be a couple months before we see it.
All right. Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We do have another caller question, so let's head in that direction now.
Hello, Professor Ramsey. This is James Lowe. I had a question about Argentina's position. What if they claim national sovereignty now and just say, too bad, we don't care what we agreed to? And if the U.S. doesn't choose to acknowledge that, what about any reciprocity issues down the road for the U.S.?
Sure. Well, I think there's maybe two parts to that. So let me take the first part first, which is whether Argentina just says we have international sovereignty, so we are just not going to cooperate. I think that is what Argentina is doing. I don't think Argentina is really making a legal argument. This is not as to the discovery point, but as to the underlying judgment. And they could well do it if they lose this case. They might do it with respect to the discovery as well. They might just say, we're not going to comply with this order. They just say, we're a foreign sovereign. You don't have authority over us. My reaction is under U.S. law, I think that doesn't have any validity because the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act is very clear that if you waive, then you lose your immunity and you can't take the waiver back. That's actually in the statute. And I think in international law is to the same effect too. I think that their appeal to sovereignty might sort of sound like an appeal to international law, but I don't think that. International law does recognize the exception for waiver, and I think there isn't any dispute that there was a waiver. So I think Argentina can say, well, we're a sovereign, so we aren't bound by your rules. But that's not really what the law is. Maybe it's what the reality on the ground is. But that would also be a question to be decided not just by our courts, but also by foreign courts where Argentina might have assets. I'm not sure if that's responsive or not, but I think that the reality, I guess I would say, beyond law is that Argentina can refuse to comply, and our courts and foreign courts can do what they can to get them to. I think it's unfortunate that Argentina is taking that position, if that is the position they're taking, because I think the international rule of law really depends on people and sovereigns following court orders. But they don't, you know, if they don't, they don't. The reciprocity question, I think, is a real interesting one. And I think that goes to the question of why is the U.S. government on Argentina's side here, which it is. The U.S. executive branch filed a brief in support of Argentina. I think that it's not so much because we're concerned about relationships with Argentina, although I think this case going forward, if Argentina doesn't get the relief it wants from these orders and also from the pari passu clause that I mentioned and so forth, I think it is going to be very bad for relations between Argentina and the United States. But I don't know how much that I don't know how much the U.S. government is worried about that in particular, as opposed to what my guess is that the U.S. government is concerned that it might be subject to discovery orders of this type by foreign countries, and that's the concern it has. But I think that if that is the reciprocity concern, I think that might well be. I wouldn't be as worried about it if the U.S. government is, because I would hope anyway that if the U.S. government had a valid judgment against it in a foreign court, it would pay it, and so it wouldn't be subject to this sort of discovery and execution dispute that Argentina's gotten itself into.
Thank you. Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We've got a few minutes left, and we've got quite a few callers on the line. Let me ask you, maybe this is a policy question, Professor, while we're waiting to see if somebody else rings in. Is there discussion in the briefs or you know, on the fringes of the case about the effect of a decision one way or another on the sovereign debt market? That is, if the court goes one way, maybe on this case, and maybe on the larger case, it will reduce the value of sovereign debt issued in this country by other developing countries, because their waiver of sovereign immunity might mean less to potential debt holders, potential purchasers of sovereign debt.
Sure. Yeah, there's actually been a lot of discussion of that. Let me be clear right now that I'm a professor of law, not a professor of economics. So I'm sort of talking off the top of my head here. I did have a degree in economics back in the midst of the last century, but that's I don't have much beyond that. But let me say I think there's arguments two ways on that. And so I think first Argentina's argument is that the problem they have is that they got in a situation where they couldn't pay on their foreign debt, and so they wanted to do this refinancing that would basically induce, compel, if you want, the private bondholders to take some losses in order to get some money out of the deal, the problem was that they had was that while a lot of bondholders agreed to that, some didn't, and NML being one of them. And so Argentina's argument is, look, you can't let NML sort of mess up this renegotiation of the debt that was agreed to by most of the bondholders. And if you take NML's side too strongly here, you will do that. But the argument on the other side is twofold. One is that, if you're worried about holdouts, in effect, in a bond renegotiation, there's an easy way to deal with that, which actually a lot of bond contracts do, which is you just say that there can be a renegotiation that can be approved by, X percent supermajority of the bondholders, two-thirds, three-quarters of the bondholders, and if an Argentine had something like that, they wouldn't have any problem with the renegotiation here, the bondholder, they might have, if you have that, you might have to pay a lower, Argentina might get less interest in its bonds, but so be it. So again, I think Argentina, maybe next time they do this kind of a bond issue, they'll have a document that looks a little different. But so that's one side of it. But the other side, which you alluded to, Dean, is that the ability in the future of foreign sovereigns, and especially developing country sovereigns to sell bonds on the private market really depends on confidence by the private bondholders that the terms of the bonds will be enforced. And if at the end of the day Argentina is doesn't satisfy its bondholders here, future bondholders, and then and if the courts sort of do things, read the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act expansively, for example, that facilitate Argentina doing that, then the problem is that future bond, prospective bond purchasers will look at developing country debt that's being offered to them and say, well, I don't know if I want that because I can't be confident that the rule of law really applies to these obligations. And one of the reasons that the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act allows waiver and that bond contract for that sovereign bond contracts typically have this waiver provision, I would say almost universally have this waiver provision, is that without it, no one's going to buy the bonds, or at least they're going to demand much, much higher interest rates. Jonathan Macy from Yale actually had an article in the Wall Street Journal a couple of days ago that I saw that made this case much more eloquently than I could, but basically to that point, that it would really be much better for the sovereign debt market to do everything you can to uphold the rule of law, because that will make it easier for foreign sovereigns, and again, especially it's the developing world countries that are most affected by this, would make it much easier for them to sell their debt if people are confident, if buyers are confident that you're looking at a rule of law regime and not just sort of a rule of whatever the foreign sovereign wants in sort of a realpolitik kind of thing where they don't have any guarantee of repayment apart from the good faith of the sovereign. So I think that's the way the arguments play out on that. And as you can tell, I'm the more sympathetic to Professor Macy's position. But I think there has been a lot of talk about the economics of this. I guess putting back my law professor hat on, my view is these kind of issues are better addressed to Congress, and it would be better to. I'd rather just see the courts enforce the statute as it's written. And if we think that the economic policy cuts the other direction, then Congress can fix it.
Very good. We do have at least one caller with a question. If you want to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call.
Thank you again. A very quick question. Again, Silvia Pisani from La Nación. You know that the Deputy Solicitor General, you addressed that issue with the reciprocity argument. The Deputy Solicitor exposed in the court in the side of Argentina. Argentina made a big issue about this. And so I would like to ask you, how did you see the participation of the Deputy Solicitor? If the judges bought his arguments or not, or how did you see his participation, please?
Yeah, you mean at the oral argument? This Monday's argument. I have learned through bad experience in the past that it's a mistake to try to read too much into the oral arguments. I do think that that sometimes the oral arguments are. Sometimes you can really see where the justices are going, but sometimes you really can't. Sometimes they're just trying out arguments, and they're not necessarily the arguments they believe. And sometimes something gets talked about a lot, and other times, and then it just disappears, and you don't hear from it again in the opinion. I guess what I would say about the point about sort of Argentina's refusing to abide by the judgment. I didn't see as much about that in the oral argument. It seemed like maybe that the justices were not as interested in that point as I would have thought perhaps they would. This was a very big deal at the Second Circuit, as Dean mentioned. They said at the Second Circuit, Argentina's counsel said, we are not going to follow the orders of the court, and I think that went over very badly with the court of appeals. Not to say that I think it changed the outcome of the case. I think Court of Appeals' judgment upholding the district court was quite a reasonable one, but I think the judges didn't like it. That issue didn't come up as much in the Supreme Court as I thought it might. The Supreme Court seemed sort of more interested in the strictly legal questions of what the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act said and what the what Rule 69 allowed courts to do. So I guess that's what I see in that. I'm not sure, though. Again, I'm not one to try to read something out of oral argument because I think you never really know what the justices are thinking there.
Well, final call for questions. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone now. Seeing none, Professor Ramsey, we've got a few minutes left. Let me see if you want to wrap up or if you have a final thought you want to express before we adjourn the call.
I think I've pretty much said the way I see the case, and I was sort of wanted to see if I could provoke more pushback, but I didn't get much. So I do want to make clear that I'm just expressing my view on this, but my view tends to come out of a sense that we ought to read statutes to say what they say and not to say more than they say, and that we ought to try to have a rule of law where we can, and that the rule of law requires not just judgments but also executions of judgments, because a judgment is just a worthless piece of paper you can pin to your wall unless you can actually either encourage or require the debtor to pay for it. So I think it's important to the rule of law to make sure that that our execution provisions are strong, and I think it's important to the rule of law to have have courts read statutes to say what they say, and if Congress decides that that's a bad result, that they can fix it. And so that's really the perspective that I'm coming to from this case. I have no particular concern about Argentina in particular. They just sort of happen to be at the defendant in this particular case. But I think this case raises some broader issues about both about how you read statutes in the face of claims of sovereign authority, and also how you enforce judgments in the face of sovereign authority, and I think that those are difficult questions. But at least where you have a sovereign that voluntarily is submitted to all this initially for in order to further its own commercial purposes, I think this is it's not an area that we need to be as concerned about diplomatically. It's an area where I think we can I hope to see anyway really uphold the rule of law in the face of some sovereign dignity objections.
Well, Professor Ramsey, thank you so much for joining us today. Maybe we can have you back when we do get a decision in this case or as the other case continues to move forward. So thank you for joining us today. Also, thanks to the audience for joining us. A reminder that tomorrow at 12 noon, we will be discussing, as the Heartbleed is dominating our headlines, we'll be discussing encryption on our Teleform conference call tomorrow at noon Eastern Time. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.